The theme for the evening is that of forgiveness, and this is one of the topics suggested in the and Mary and the others here were brainstorming for different useful themes for these meditation classes, and I thought this was a particularly, well, they've all been particularly ripe ripe topics, but this one also is very, very helpful. It's not a thing that we often think about in our everyday life. It doesn't sort of grab our attention, but yet that the quality of forgiveness or lack of forgiveness has a can have a very pervasive effect on the way we hold the world, the way we relate to our families, to the people around us, to to our country, and you know, to the world in general. I think it's particularly useful to reflect on because our culture is a very unforgiving culture. You know, the Judeo-Christian conditioning, the Old Testament thinking is the vengeful God. Yeah, I remember, and many of you might have seen a Gary Larson cartoon many years ago of God sitting in front of his computer terminal, got a long white beard and the white robes, and on the computer screen there's this one of Larson's hapless characters walking along a sidewalk with a piano hanging from a crane hook above his head, and then God's finger poised over the smite button. So those of us who remember our sort of contact with the Bible and sort of the biblical Christianity and so forth, there's a lot of smiting that goes on. And God is a vengeful God, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and so on and so forth. So I'm not intending this evening to be a kind of anti-Judeo-Christian rant, but just noticing how even if we didn't grow up with much apparent religious conditioning at all, it's significant because this affects the whole culture that we live in, how we're taught, the attitudes of the people around us, those who affected us and who continue to affect us. You know, particularly in the kind of the broader scope of things, vengeance, revenge is seen as utterly normal. If someone hurts you, you know, then you strike back, and that the idea of forgiveness or not taking revenge, not settling the score, is often taken as a kind of weakness. But in a way, one of the most significant, powerful teachings of Jesus was in, I think it's in the Sermon on the Mount, where he talks about turning the other cheek. If someone strikes you on the right side of the face, you know, turn the other cheek. And I remember as a kid thinking, well, what on earth does that mean? And that, and then when you find out it means, okay, you hit my right side, please. You know, take the left too. It's like, huh? So it's a teaching or a guidance towards complete antithesis of taking revenge, but kind of moving the mind, moving the intention in the opposite direction. And so in Buddhist practice, it's a very, very similar approach. That we can understand the sort of instinctual feeling for being unforgiving, for wanting scores to be settled or taking revenge. But as Gandhi said, an eye for an eye, pretty soon the whole world will become blind. If we take an eye for an eye, then the whole world will become blind. So to first of all understand or to reflect on how strongly we're conditioned towards vengeance or bearing grudges or carrying criticism, negativity around and not forgiving. And also seeing how the act of forgiveness seems to be regarded as a weakness. Like, it's kind of interesting how, of the many teachings of Jesus, that turning the other cheek is like completely ignored in many, many respects. It's like, well, we'll forget that one. You know, let's get back to the smiting. You know, just, you know, just like me as a little kid, not being able to figure out what that meant. It's like, just, I think culturally there's that sense of, what? You know, they attack you and you just say, please, you know, hit the other side as well. Like, what? You're out of your mind. So to cognize how we hold that sense of it being justified in resenting someone's behavior, justified in being unforgiving towards ourselves, towards others, and that if we do forgive, then that's taken as a sign of weakness. You know, you just haven't got the strength to make your case or to fight back or set the other person straight. This person doesn't deserve to be forgiven, or, you know, I don't deserve to be forgiven. No, we should be punished. And so that, you know, with the, you know, even though that the there is a lot of spirit of, say, forgiveness in the Christian side of things, certainly those who've grown up in a Catholic environment, that the kind of lack of self-forgiveness or feeling you can't do enough in order to sort of set things right or to be forgiven or to be purified is very, very strong. So just to be aware of these sort of cultural influences and to see how hard we can be on others, how hard we can be on ourselves, and seeing how that quality of forgiveness is seen as a weakness. Or I think in the little blurb that was put out for this evening, I was quoting a bumper sticker I saw on the Golden Gate Bridge one day on a vehicle which said, "To err is dysfunctional. To forgive is codependent." So the Bay Area is very good for these nifty bumper stickers. So to err is dysfunctional, to forgive is codependent. I thought, well, that's not terribly Buddhist, but but that in a way you can see how we see that as there's something, there can be something wrong in us to forgive, or that's something is not quite on the mark, and that we should take action, we should be setting people straight, we should be taking revenge, we should bear a grudge, we should not forgive. And sometimes, and I know these are fairly sweeping statements, but what these kind of principles can do is they guide our perceptions and the way we hold each other, the way we hold the world, into this kind of very imbalanced state. So what I'd like to do this evening is try to show how the quality of forgiveness is actually a very beautiful and powerful act, and is neither it's not a sign of weakness or codependency. But is in a way as a gesture of great spiritual maturity. Some of the chanting that we do, often we've done in these evenings, one of the verses that we recite is the what's called the verses of sharing an aspiration or the sharing of blessings. And as we recite those verses, it begins by going through a long list of different kinds of beings and people. And it starts off with those who we have a very positive attitude towards, our spiritual teachers or our parents and, you know, friends and loved ones. And then it goes through the list of those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth and the Lord of Death, and this kind of formal lists of beings. And so, and then when you get to the end of all these beings, including those who are hostile towards us, those who are ill-intentioned, those who are harmful and destructive, then after we've completed the whole list, then we say, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. You know, what? I don't want to share the goodness of my life with those guys. You know, no, they should be punished. You know, I don't want to share my good karma with the warmongers and those who've deliberately harmed me or my loved ones. It's like, not them. You know, they should be punished. Or that'll only, if you're kind and friendly to them, that'll only encourage them. You know, they'll think they can get away with it, right? And I know you can almost feel this sort of ripple go through the room sometimes when we recite those verses. You know, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless, which is, you know, a Buddhist way of saying may they be totally happy and have the experience of spiritual bliss and a kind of heavenly transcendence, heavenly bliss. And so it goes very much counter to that culture of vengeance, the culture of punishment. And I think that's a very useful thing. It's very beautiful and helpful because what we don't realize is that if we pour more negativity onto, you know, those who have done wrong, either outside, you know, whether it's towards the government or towards some institution or some individual who's hurt us or harmed us or our loved ones, or whether it's towards ourselves, you know, more negativity, more hatred is not going to help. Right? You're just pouring gasoline onto the fire. And so that, just as Gandhi observed, you know, pretty soon the whole world will become blind. It's like, you know, if you pile hatred and negativity on those who are already destructive and harmful, what's going to happen? And so that sometimes the most powerful thing is the gesture of forgiveness, the gesture of I hold no ill will towards you. I don't necessarily approve of all your actions. And this is a theme that comes up very, very frequently in the teachings and in these classes and you know, other places that we teach, and in the Buddha's teaching itself. So there's a clear distinction, and this is one of the most important things, is that by forgiving you, by forgiving me, it's not saying I approve of every action that I've ever done, or I approve of everything I've ever said. It's absolutely fine and good and perfect, beautiful. It's not giving a blanket approval for all kind of action and speech that we have done or others have done or that they continue to do. But it's saying, regardless of what you've done or said, I have complete and boundless well-wishing towards you. I have nothing but benevolence towards you as a being. Your actions might be worthy of criticism, but you as an individual I love completely. Now, in our Western conditioning, again, we kind of mush those together. That if I love you, that means I must approve of all your actions. I mean, if we think it through, it doesn't really work that way, but it's not really a thinking thing, it's a feeling. This is happening in the feeling department. And so then if we feel that if others are criticizing my actions, then they're criticizing me. If they disapprove of my actions, they disapprove of me, because we're totally identified with our words and actions and attitudes. But one of the most useful and powerful things of Buddhist practice is that you're sort of teasing apart those elements, or seeing that in fact they are separate elements, and that you can love a being completely, wholeheartedly, and unambiguously. Unhypocritically and totally disapprove of their actions. and so when we're talking about forgiving ourselves or forgiving others, we're not trying to pretend that we like everything that they do or we approve or everything that they do is actually wholesome or beautiful or worthy or excusable. But we're saying, I love you completely, that I have nothing but affection towards you, but you know, some of your actions are wholesome and good, and some of your actions are unwholesome and harmful. Some are neutral. So that when we are talking about forgiveness, we are in the Buddhist sense. What we're talking about is that finding that clarity within our hearts, where we can be unboundedly benevolent towards others, but unconfused about how we relate to their actions and speech. Does that make sense? Yeah? So a lot of the meditation and the kind of little guidance I was giving during the sitting is to do with rousing that quality of well-wishing towards ourselves, well-wishing towards others. And it's finding that quality of benevolence and kindness towards others. But it's important to be working towards and using, in a way, our reflective faculty and the qualities of intuitive wisdom to do that teasing apart. And to see that to approve or to love someone doesn't mean to say that we have to approve of everything that they do. And that when we are, offering forgiveness or asking for forgiveness, what we're doing is we're relating to that pure heart, that which underlies the spiritual nature of all beings. We're relating to that. And putting the actions and speech into a secondary position, because the most important thing is that we find that quality of affinity and love and total oneness with others, a total welcoming and kindness, benevolence towards others. In our monastic tradition, Southern Buddhist countries, there's a little ritual, a ceremony that is carried out several times a year. Usually when you've been living together with someone for a long time, let's say you've been in a retreat time together, 3 months retreat, or when you've been living in a monastery for some time and you're about to go off and stay somewhere else, then there's a formal asking for forgiveness. And so this is the way that, you know, in a way, you always part company. You always carry out this ceremony when you've been together with someone for a long time, and then you part company. And so I thought this would be very useful to share with you all. Maybe Mary can include it in your teacher training program. And so that this is, and it's a very powerful. I'm not that you feel obliged, but you might find it very helpful, because what you do is that. Either sort of person to person, or an individual to the person who's been leading the group, or that, you know, the whole group together with to the person who's leading it. You say, whatever I have done by body, speech, or mind, intentionally or unintentionally, consciously or unconsciously, that has been hurtful or painful to you in any way whatsoever, for that I ask for your forgiveness. And then. The person in return, in the sort of formal exchange, says, I forgive you and I ask you to forgive me also. Now, this is really interesting in that is always carried out. Even if the person, say that you've been staying with someone who's regarded as a sort of great enlightened being and sort of totally beyond any kind of harmful or selfish intention, still they will say, I forgive you and please forgive me also. So that even someone who's a totally enlightened being will not assume that they are beyond hurting other people's feelings. Because even the Buddha in his own lifetime, that there was numerous occasions where he said things or did things that people found offensive or upsetting. Even his own disciples would sometimes kind of take offense at things that he said, or the other enlightened disciples of the Buddha, they would do things or say things that other people were hurt by. So there's no harmful intention, no kind of selfish or cruel or a kind of biased intention in any way whatsoever. But still, you know, as happens in life, you know, the road to hell is paved with those very good intentions. You know, that there's a reason why that aphorism exists. So this is a very beautiful and powerful way of establishing a relationship and connection, so that you are clearing the slate, and you're in a way contacting that same space, that same quality of loving kindness and forgiveness. So you're drawing upon that more expansive view that no matter if you've done we've been living together and you've been kind of belligerent, selfish, and deliberately nasty to me this whole time. not that Mary would have done that slightly possible, you know, for teacher trainees or in the monastery, you might not have intended that, but even if it has happened that way, that you've been biased against someone and being kind of narrow-minded and selfish and critical and hard on them, then or they've been that way to you, then you go through the ceremony, and even if in a way, if you don't really mean it, you know, you're supposed to do this ceremony, right? So this, you've got to do the asking for forgiveness. And meanwhile, what might be at the surface of your mind is like, I want vengeance, and I want this guy to suffer, and he shouldn't have done that. And he did this, and he did this, and then he did that, and then he did this. And we kind of got our long list of gripes and complaints and grudges. Still, just by the power of saying those words, it actually opens the door to that in you which says, why are you carrying this around? Why are you making yourself miserable, bearing all this? And what a burden, what a hassle, what a headache. It'd be much easier just to create that space and to let go. So that's why forgiveness is a strength rather than a weakness, because you're drawing upon that in you which is bigger than the complaints about other people. And it's a even though it can be seen as a sort of as a formality, it does have it does have that strength, and it does genuinely tap into that quality of the heart, because at least at that very moment it's reflected back to you what you're carrying around, even if you're determined to carry it around regardless, even as you're saying, you know, I ask for your forgiveness, and you're trying not to mean it. It's still. You're aware of what you've got to hang on to in order to keep that going, and that feels really stupid. Yeah. And you know something in you knows that, and even that awareness of that this is really stupid, that's helpful, because if we don't have that reflection, we'll just carry on with that and feel justified and kind of keep it going. So that kind of practice is a very powerful and beautiful thing. And now I just finished doing the family summer camp, a family retreat at Spirit Rock. About 32 families gather together for this retreat time. And this is how they finish the retreat, is that the children and the parents ask forgiveness of each other. And it's quite a wonderful, and they adopted this from the monastic tradition that we taught. It's a very beautiful thing. You have these little, like, four and 5 year olds, saying, I forgive you, Daddy, and please forgive me also. Yeah. And the parents saying, please forgive me for whatever I might have done, my body, speech, or mind. You know, and it's quite a wonderful thing. And then they also they include a string, tying the string on each other's wrist. So then the string that you tie on each other's wrist then becomes a symbol of the asking and offering for forgiveness.
It's a bit of a departure from the days of Father Knows Best.
Indeed so.
When I was growing up, you wouldn't do that with your parents. Because in a way they were viewed as infallible.
Viewed?
Yeah.
You mean they weren't infallible?
Yeah. They were. Supposed to be.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's why it's one of those most beautiful things.
Yeah.
Father.
That's lovely.
Yeah. And it's a wonderful thing. Maybe the last thing I thought to talk about is, even when we feel a lot of resentment and grudges and negativity towards others and to other people, often our sort of ex-spouses, may all beings be happy except her. sometimes that's the most difficult, or kind of it's really in the way where with our former, those who we tied the knot with. And those that we are now not with can be very, very, very hard. But then even beyond that, we can find that, and again, this is sort of oftentimes the Judeo-Christian conditioning, particularly amongst people who've been brought up as Catholics, is very prominent, is that forgiving ourselves for not being perfect and good and right, it's really, really hard because of having a massive amount of conditioning of, I'm not good enough, I'm not, don't try hard enough, and if others are suffering, it's my fault. you know, should try harder, should be better, should be a better, you know, son, daughter, you know, partner, student, teacher. You know, I'm not good enough. I don't try hard enough. I'm not strong enough, etc. But
that's my specialty.
Yeah, I think, and it's an important thing to recognize that along that list, in Buddhist practice of loving kindness meditation, the first person that you spread loving kindness to is yourself. Because if you can't have that acceptance and love and forgiveness for yourself and all your qualities, how can you possibly love anybody else? It's the Buddhist logic. Whereas in our conditioning is in the West is much more towards, well, I can manage loving everybody else, but moi? No, I should be punished. No, I do deserve to be unloved and hated. I should be kind of, discarded.
I should suffer.
I deserve to suffer. You know, I'm a bad person. I should suffer. And so that quality of forgiveness and offering forgiveness is a very useful thing. And one of the practices I often suggest, and I think I was talking about it to the teacher trainee group when you all came to the monastery the other evening, is if you imagine that you were your best friend. So if Reverend Sekai imagines that Reverend Sekai comes to him and says, you know, of all the beings in the world, I am the most unforgivable. I've done terrible, nasty things. And I've done this, 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 and this, and this. You know, and I really feel that I'm one of the most awful people on the planet.
That's pretty much how it worked.
Yeah. So, but if you imagine that you are Reverend Sekai's best friend,
yeah,
and he comes to you and he says that, then what arises in the heart immediately?
It's a load of baloney.
Absolutely. And even before you can finish the first sentence. It's like, that's a load of baloney. You're a lovely person. You know, you've been a monk for 29 years. If you were really as bad and rotten and nasty and deceitful and conceited and arrogant and stupid and incompetent as you think you are, you wouldn't want to come anywhere near anyone who was so good-hearted and pure people who meditate. You'd want to go out and be sort of seething amongst the kind of the nasty, destructive, obsessed lowlifes. Yeah, that's where you'd want to be if you were really that bad. You know, if you were really so nasty, why would you want to even come to a yoga mendocino on a Wednesday night? You know, why would you want to be around good people? That'd be so off-putting to be around all these kind of goody-goodies. Meditators. Yogis. Ugh. Buddhists, ugh. Right? And you know that immediately. So one of these ways of doing this is, so if you imagine doing an asking for forgiveness with yourself, so it's a little imaginative exercise. You know, that there you are. You're some kind of undefined, unspecified friendly being, and then you, your best friend, come up and say, you know, please forgive me for whatever I've done, bad body, speech, or mind. And just feel that quality arising within you. Because whenever I do this exercise, or I encourage it to other people, it's immediate, there's compassion and forgiveness. It's just what is thoughtlessly, wordlessly, it's just, yes! What a load of baloney, you're fine, you're lovely, what a beautiful person. How can you really believe that? Garbage. You know, you're fine. And it wells up from the heart in a complete and full way. So that when we can recognize that and cultivate that, we see that this is a great strength in ourselves. It's not just being wishy-washy. It's a power. It's a great strength of the heart that we can really draw upon. So I offer these thoughts for consideration and reflection this evening. And
May I say something about guilt?
Please, yeah.
Being someone who was brought up in one of the Protestant Judeo-Christian churches, not Catholic, by the way, but close enough, I was brought up in an environment in which there was what I would call an undercurrent of guilt. and that guilt was something that everyone should feel because of our fallen nature as human beings. We have original sin, and we're fallen by nature, and as a result of that falling, we need to be saved. Okay? This is a whole paradigm, an idea which is contrary to Buddhism. And teachers in Asia, when they hear that American people have this problem, they sort of go, what? you feel what? Guilt? Just because you're alive? Just because you're a human being walking on this planet and living and consuming things, etc.? What I've come to learn over time is that guilt is... what I would describe as a little hardness of heart turned inward on yourself. Everything Ajahn Amaro has been talking about tonight has to do with the softening of the heart. The softening of the heart towards other people. The softening of the heart towards the people that you live with, the people in your family, the people that you work with. And perhaps above all, the softening of the heart towards yourself. Okay? So guilt, even though it's very, very subtle and insidious element of human consciousness, there is actually a way to soften and purify it, which is that when you notice yourself turning guilt, turning that little bit of hardness of heart onto yourself, there is a mechanism which is best described by, I think, the wish or the intention that you were talking about earlier, which is to open the heart, okay? To soften the heart and say, okay, here is guilt, but now I choose to let it go. You follow that? There's a sort of an offering that's made. Offer it to whatever in yourself is greater than that little bit of hardness or that little bit of suffering that you experience. And it works. There's something greater and yet within all of us that loves and accepts all. There is a huge all-embracing love and acceptance that we can all experience. All we have to do is take advantage of it. And that little bit of guilt, that little bit of anger or hardness turned inwards, we just take it and offer it and accept it. And it's part of that softening of the heart process that you've been describing. It's another way of talking about the taking of in Buddhism what we call loving kindness and turning it inwards on ourselves. And in a sense, it's like the cool flowing water of a stream, if any of you have ever gone hiking up in the mountains, and it's a hot day and you're sort of sweating and grimy and you take off your shoes and as much of your clothes as you can and you just sit in the water and it just flows through you. And you feel totally refreshed as a result of it. It's what we can do as a result of turning the stream of compassion inwards. Mm-hmm. Thank you. My little two cents.
Any comments or questions or clarifications? Yeah, a hand there.
Ajahn Amaro, I hear you saying that you can forgive but not approve someone's action.
Mm-hmm.
How do you rationalize or justify political activism, for example, to protest the actions of our government that many of us find despicable? So how do you protest with great passion and forgive at the same time?
With practice. I think it's in a way it's important to use the meditation to clarify the motivation that we have. so that your actions are based on love, and and well wishing for the greater well being of the country and the world, and then out of that love and that good intention, then if what you need to do is organize a trip to DC and pull a march together and get everybody up with their costumes and their placards and make a loud noise, then that's done from a place of love and well-wishing, rather than these bastards should be punished. And because, as I said, more anger, more hatred only contributes to the confusion. And so it doesn't mean to say if you're coming from a place of love and well-wishing, you can still raise a loud voice and make a powerful and colorful protest, but you're not doing it out of hatred. And that's actually much more powerful and has more of a penetrative effect. When something is just negative and is attacking us from a place of aversion, it's much easier for us to protect ourselves and just kind of wall it off and just not allow it in. When someone criticizes us or says something that we don't want to hear, but you know that they are coming from a place of kindness and empathy and well-wishing, even though our voice might say, "What do you mean?" in our heart we know, "Gee, she's right." And even if we fend it off right then and there, something in us says, "God damn, they're right, you know." And we might keep our defense going for a while, but it's actually eroded. Because it's come from a good place, it's eroding our own embedded position. So, but it takes, that's one of the most useful things with the meditation, is clarifying the motivation and then establishing a wholesome motivation. Like both seeing where we're coming from, first of all, then if where we're coming from is a place of harshness and vengeance and ill will, then turning that, genuinely, refusing to follow that and finding a place of where you have a genuine love. Like I think in the instance of Julia Butterfly and the head of the Maxim Corporation, it's because she upset a lot of the environmental activists because she refused to hate and encourage hatred for the logging company. That she and that was actually much more powerful in the long run. That she refused to buy into that, off with their heads, which is an understandable emotion that one can feel, but she wouldn't go along with it. And actually the fact that the Horowitz, when they met, that he realized, gee, she doesn't hate me. Wow. Then it kind of moves towards a more of a collaboration. It kind of got through in a way that Horowitz, you are an evil, et cetera, et cetera. And so, if you've got enough protection and smarts, you can just wall yourself off against that completely and easily. But when, someone is saying, "No, I care about you. You. The actual real you." Then that kind of finds its way in. And then the changes that can be brought about and not done, are done more with finding a commonality rather than just sort of resentful capitulation on whoever's, sort of got to cave in because of, because of pressure one kind or another.
Can I tell a story?
Sure. Yeah.
In the early days of the monastery where I trained, Shasta Abbey, in the Zen tradition, there's a mealtime ceremony in which, in Japan, they would offer the merit of taking the meal, okay, and they would share it with the Buddha, the Emperor, our parents, and all people, okay. These are known as the four benefactors. So my master took that ceremony from Japan, and she translated it into English. So that over in America, we could do basically the same thing, only we would understand it, and, you know, we wouldn't just be, you know, reciting Japanese that we didn't understand. So she translated it as the Buddha, the president, our parents, and all people. Now, those of you who are old enough to remember the 70s, the early 70s, Richard Nixon was president of the United States. And in the early days of the monastery, the monks were just about all, you know, pretty young people in their 20s. And I'm telling you, Nixon was reviled. He was hated. He was public enemy number one. He was an idiot. Okay? He was a bigot, a fool, and a jerk. Okay? Now, here you are. Here you are in a Zen monastery, and you're sitting in front of your food. You're trying to meditate. And then you're saying, we share the merit of this food, offering, with Richard Nixon? You're kidding. Okay, so I'm telling the story because in that moment, you know, whatever you feel personally about a politician of the ilk of, let's say, Richard Nixon, and I'm not trying to disparage him or his memory. I'm just telling a story. What Ajahn Amaro is talking about is that you may not agree with what a person does, but you still respect their, what we would call their Buddha nature, that this is still a human being, okay? Regardless of what they have done or what they represent, we still cultivate goodwill. Okay? We still cultivate kindness. We send them merit so that they will be a success in what they do. And so you have to simply put down, I don't like this person, or I disapprove of this person, or I hate this person. You just put it down. There's something more important than that. Those are just feelings. And what's more important is the reality that we all, regardless of who we are, where we have come from, and what we have done, we all still have the same inherent Buddhahood or Buddha nature, and that we should honor that. We should honor it in ourselves, and we should honor it in other people. So we have practices that show us how to do that. And it's a daily practice. I mean, it doesn't necessarily come easy, okay? Which is why in monastic practice, you do these things over and over and over. That's the nature of practice. You just do it again and again, and then it eventually becomes second nature.
Speaking of bumper stickers, I saw one about a week ago that said, Richard Nixon is now no longer the worst president ever. But also, and just reflecting on something that Reverend Sekai was saying then, and also earlier, that about guilt and original sin, that even amongst the Christian realm, that they started to talk, seeing the negative effect of that idea, they start to talk about original blessing rather than original sin.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad to hear it.
Yeah, it's somewhat disenfranchised Catholic priest, Bay Area. The Vatican was not terribly pleased with him, but that's shifting the view, because that's very much within, you know, the Buddhist practices. Our fundamental nature is pure and radiant. The true nature of mind is pure and radiant. Whereas the kind of Freudian Judeo-Christian model is that the fundamental nature of mind is a swamp of nastiness. You know, right down in the basement. At least there's the id. Yeah, the ill-behaved id, and then there's all the kind of, the other kind of self-critical feelings, like you say, you know, original sin and the id are kind of basically what you end up with. Mm-hmm. And so the from the Buddhist perspective, and also in meditation, this is not just a belief system, but also what we experience, that when the mind, just as, say, when we were having the meditation period this evening, you notice when the mind is in its clearest moments, when you're caught up in a thought or a memory or a feeling, and then you recognize, oh, my mind is planning, or I'm resenting this ache in my leg. Oh, okay, let go. And in that moment of letting go, what do we find? But there's peacefulness, the mind is bright, it's clear, there's no sense of I. Just, you know, even just in a half second or quarter second of letting go, then when the mind is not confused by any kind of clinging, when we let go, what's there is purity, radiance, peacefulness. And if you don't believe me, you can see it for yourself and then just repeat the above a million times over. And every single time that there's letting go, what is found is purity, radiance, peacefulness, no sense of I, no sense of separateness, and a quality of wholeness. Every time. So if you just let the evidence mount, you know, those of you, any statisticians amongst us, you know, a million trials and you get the same result a million times over, begins to convince us that, wow, you know, when all the confusion is not there, what we find is this pure, beautiful quality. So perhaps that's what lies at the basis, rather than the swamp of guilt and the id, and that we just let that evidence, that realization, speak for itself. Any other questions? Yeah, down here.
I'd like to ask one of you, whoever feels moved to reply. When you were bringing up about forgiveness, lack of forgiveness turned inward, and the guilt and self-criticism, what I would like to ask about is a way that we can really honestly look at ourselves and see our mistakes and be able to grow without that triggering guilt and lack of forgiveness. Because what I find is that when I'm getting some feedback, or I see I did something that may have hurt somebody, that when the guilt gets triggered, then the whole process shuts down and I don't want to look at it. And then, you know, and then if you're kind of in this very sealed world, you can't really progress because it's so painful to look at your mistakes. So some guidance for how we can do this without it triggering the unskillful process.
In Buddhism, what we come to recognize is that mistakes aren't the end of the world. In fact, it's how we learn is through trial and error. Okay? And so the courage to get out there and make mistakes is a healthy thing in human life. And unfortunately, a lot of our conditioning, as you're saying, can hinder the process of simply learning from our mistakes, because right away we turn and we jump in to the swamp of ill feeling turned inward, of thinking, oh God, I'm such an idiot. Oh God, I did that for the 100th time. Oh God, why don't I ever learn? You know, da 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 da. You know how easy it is for the mind to churn out that kind of thinking, that God, I'm a fool, you know, you son of a bitch, you know, da 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 da. And so maybe what's useful to do is, in the wake of something that triggers off that kind of a response, is to make an agreement with yourself that, okay, I'm going to take, you know, however much time is necessary, 5 or 10 minutes, or a day. I don't know. It depends on you. But to just sit and face that part of yourself that inevitably is going to come to the surface. Because what you don't want to do is try to smash it back down into its Pandora's box, okay, or its little hellhole. But rather allow it to come to the surface. And so, okay, if we need to deal with this first before we can look at the other thing, okay, that we need to learn from, fine. Okay, because this is still part of the equation of being a human being and being alive here and now. Okay, and I have this guilt or self-judgment and self-criticism coming up. Okay, so you let it come up, all right, but don't buy into it. Okay, so that is a skill, a learned skill in meditation, that you allow those kinds of feelings and emotions to come to the surface, and yet something in you is willing to say, okay, have your say, but I'm not buying into this. Okay? Which is what underlies the ability to let our dark side, the dark side of our consciousness, or whatever you want to say, our mental makeup as human beings. Okay, have your say. I'm going to sit and listen to it, and that's fine, but then I'm not going to buy into it. And that is a conversion process in which the force is diminished. The force of that mental habit, that habit energy, is diminished. And you can also begin to do what John Amaro was talking about, of allowing loving acceptance of that part of yourself, okay, to come forward. Like I was talking about before, it's a little hardness of heart that I think pretty much everyone has to some degree or another, and we soften it, okay? We soften our hearts towards the very things within ourselves that we find most difficult. Then, once you've given that its say and its time and its period of coming up, then you can turn your attention back to what actually happened, okay? If you wronged someone or you made a mistake in some, you know, relationship or business dealing or whatever it happened to be. And then without the guilt and the self-judgment piled on, then you can actually look at that in a clearer light and say, well, what actually happened here? Okay? And what can I learn from this? And without all that other stuff sort of going blah, 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 then it's much easier to look at what actually happened and get a sense for, okay, what really happened was I was trying to force the issue, you know, or I had a desire here, you know, which ran counter to what was truly productive, or whatever. I mean, those are just hypothetical. And then you can learn from that, okay, and incorporate that into your life, okay? And so although guilt may be there and it may come up repeatedly, at least then you have the tools in your hands to say, okay, there's my old friend guilt, okay? Well, there's my old friend self-judgment. And, you know, I used to be kind of in a position of being a slave to that, but no more. Okay? No more. I'm not buying into it. And we mainly do that with acceptance and loving kindness. That's primarily how it's converted. We also need the discipline, you know, of just not believing it.
Interestingly enough, one of the ways that we can very effectively kind of retrain the mind, because it's a kind of cognitive therapy. I mean, a lot of Buddhist meditation is 2,500-year-old cognitive therapy. Seriously. So it's like deliberately changing your thinking patterns. And So one of the ways that you can do exactly what Reverend Sekhai was saying is counterintuitive, but it's to actually firmly state to yourself the very criticisms that the mind is making. So like to say, you know, clearly and distinctly to yourself, I am a useless person. Yeah, I deserve to be punished. Yeah. Other faults of other people can be forgiven. I shouldn't be forgiven. And yeah, you're right, you start to chuckle. Because you can hardly get to the end of the sentence before something cracks open and says, come on. But it's by giving it full voice. It's like when it's off in the wings murmuring, and all you're doing is saying, shut up, go away, you don't exist. No, no, you're not real, you're not real. Then and it's all there, and you can just see it out the corner of your eyes. It's not there, it's not there, go away, you're not real, you're not real, you're not real. So then instead of just trying to, you know, even though that's well-intentioned, and saying, no, I'm going to have loving kindness towards you, you're not real, you're not real, I'm going to have loving kindness towards you, you know, I love you, and yes we are, and we're here, and we're true, it's all true, what we're saying. shut up, it's not true, you know. But when instead of, you kind of break that dynamic, you say, okay, maybe it's true, please, tell me, give me the whole story, front, center, lights on, right, tell me. Yes. You're bad. You're really bad. It's like, oh yeah, and how am I bad? You know, it can't stand up. It can't hold up in the full light of attention. And by saying, please tell me more. What's the truth here? And just by stating those sort of undercurrents is a very, very powerful way of deflating it. And you know, if you sincerely do that, then the, you know, and say, well, okay, let's spell this out. You find that you really can't get hardly to the end of a sentence before you start cracking up, like, because the heart knows that's not the whole story. It can't be the whole story. How could it be that my crimes are of, you know, all the things that have been done in the world, that, you know, what I have done is so, or have felt or thought is so unforgivable? You know, it's laughable. But you're not making it laughable by overriding it with some other kind of positive thinking, but you're just seeing the frailty of its own argument just by giving it full light and full attention. Please. And so, and that works for all kinds of for other attitudes. You know, even the things that you might feel guilty about, like, you know, I hate my mother. I wish she would suffer a lot. And even though you might feel that, you know, the waves of those sort of very nasty, vindictive feelings, again, that you can't really get to the end of it. Well, I think, yeah, I get that emotion sometimes, but I don't really want that person to suffer. You know, that you find that place in your heart that is bigger than that. I mean, that's maybe a subject for a whole other evening, but oh, Mary's vanished. Oh, she transported. She apparated. You apparated. Impressive, huh? So that, and in a way, you need to not let it just sort of be a blurry mush, but more, particularly when you're meditating and the mind is quite clear and focused, and then. If you're noticing those self-critical or guilt-ridden feelings coming through, just to then, at that point, state them sort of clearly and fully internally. And it's very, very powerful, because you're drawing upon your own intuitive wisdom of what's the fact. You're not just trying to override it with a nicer idea, but you're drawing upon your genuine existent knowledge that there's you know, the picture is bigger than that. So I see that 9 o'clock has come upon us already. I know there was some appeal for longer evenings.
No, it's like so many people even questions. I get through two.
Could have maybe one, if people can cope with a little, one more question? Or if there are any other questions in the room? Yeah. Well, that's one of the. I mean, that's not at all an uncommon situation. The people who we feel, negativity towards are no longer around, not physically present, or they passed away. Well, one of the things that that one can do is to, again, using the meditation and the power of imagination and reflective thought, is like, talk to your father. So bring up the image of your father in your mind, or his name, and then. You carry out this kind of asking for forgiveness, and offering forgiveness. Also, you can use this kind of practice I was just describing, like say to him all the things you want to say to him, and just in the sort of clear light of awareness, seeing how much of it really holds up. I resent you, Dad, because you did X, Y, Z, and you were like this and like that, and then. Not in just seeing what arises with that, not looking for a particular effect, but oftentimes the way we relate to others, our emotional world is very blurry, and we feel waves of emotion, and we're not clear about what we're feeling or why we're feeling it or how it's directed. So what you're doing is you're creating a kind of clear and open space in order to examine and to get to know what those emotions are. So that if within that space, so the mind is focused and steady, and then you bring up the idea of your father and you say to him, I feel this resentment towards you, Father, because... of this, and because of this, and because of this. And then as you make each statement in a kind of clear and conscious way, then see what comes after, see what comes with it. Listen to what your own heart says in relationship to that. And then you try to keep it sort of steady and clear. So if the mind starts to sort of run off and say, and then, like, wait, yeah. Go back to the body, back to the breath, and let things clear out. And say, when you did such and such, that really upset me, and then that you always were like this, and that was hard to bear. And then just bring those things up and just let them sit there and feel them. Let yourself feel that kind of what's in your heart, the memory of those times, and then allow that quality of knowing and awareness, to be like the healing agent, so that you, because also along with feelings of resentment or negativity, that there's something in us feels uncomfortable about generating that and holding that, and so just sometimes where you can't really get any kind of perspective on some sort of hatred, that someone's really hurt your feelings, it's really painful, just to let ourselves fully feel that hatred or fear, or desire, whatever it might be, just bring that up and just let ourselves fully and clearly feel that anger, hatred. Feel it in the body. Where is it in the body? Feeling it. So you're trying to keep it as uncomplicated as possible. Just say, how does this feel? Not telling myself I shouldn't be feeling this or I'm justifying it, just here it is. How does it feel? So that actual quality of loving kindness is an acceptance is there for that feeling of anger. You can't quite get to your father, but at least you can have a loving kindness for the anger. Acceptance of the anger that you feel towards him. So that you're letting yourself be with that, and then accommodating that, being with that, then you can find what would generally arise is that this is really uncomfortable. This is a painful thing to carry around. And you know, just being aware of how burdensome that is, or how painful that is, what a kind of cramping of the heart that brings. And you can't necessarily just dispel it or make it go away, like, oh, well, that's that then, you know. But just, oh, this is a real, you know, this really creates isolation and a kind of enclosure of the heart. Oh, okay, you know, now I'm aware of that. And everything else that might be there that's justified, this comes with it. This is a major part of it. Like, oh, yeah, I feel justified in this anger, and it's definitely strong, and it's definitely there, but boy, this is a kind of a horrible state to be in. And then its own discomfort, its own diminished and isolating quality is the very thing that then helps to encourage us to let go and get beyond it. We just did. Oh, we're asking for forgiveness?
Yeah.
Sure.
No, I mean, like, set it up for us. I know I have to ask for forgiveness, but can we set it up so that, you know, what we do at the end
of the retreat? Sure, yeah. So, the usual way, we do. We could sort of repeat it together. Usually, either towards me or Reverend Sekai or towards each other. How would you like to do it? All of you. You want everything, don't you? Well, everybody in this room, you probably have one other person in the room that you know or have at least been sharing a corner with, so maybe if we can sort of do it in pairs, so find someone that that you are familiar with you came here with, or someone that you know, so you can just sort of turn towards each other. And if you don't have a particular friend, just someone who's been sitting near you for the evening. It doesn't have to be someone that you can do it in threes as well, that's fine. If the numbers don't quite work out. Okay. I'm just about to.
Hello.
So, as I was describing, we do go one person at a time, and so the first person would say, whatever I have done, intentionally or unintentionally, consciously or unconsciously, by body, speech, or mind, that has been painful or upsetting, offensive to you, for that I ask for your forgiveness. You remember that? No, okay. Okay.
Repeat after me.
Just follow Dad. For whatever I have done, intentionally or unintentionally, consciously or unconsciously,
consciously or unconsciously,
by body, speech, or mind,
by body, speech, or mind,
for that I ask for your forgiveness.
For that I ask for your forgiveness.
Okay, then the second person says, I forgive you.
I forgive you.
And whatever I have done,
whatever I have done,
intentionally or unintentionally,
consciously or unconsciously,
by body, speech, or mind, that has been offensive or painful to you in any way, for that I ask for your forgiveness.
For that I ask for your forgiveness.
Sadhu. That means it is well. Sadhu. Okay? So now you got the method down. Repeat. Repeat the dose as applicable. No. Well, another wonderful evening. Courtesy of our hosts, Yoga Mendocino. So a few announcements. Mary made a few at the beginning. By the way, this is Mary Pafford, whom some of you might not know, who is one of the major coordinators and teachers here at Yoga Mendocino. And so she runs all kinds of gazillions of yoga classes of all kinds. And on Sunday, here, there will be a day long beginning at 9 in the morning and going till 4 in the afternoon. 4:30. Ah, okay. 4:30 is fine. So, and that will be on the subject of
authenticity and tradition.
There you go.
A day retreat?
Potluck, I think.
For those who are coming, it will be really helpful to know if you're coming. And also, if you would be willing to bring some food to share with the monks and everybody else. What time do you need?
We need to be finished by 1, so probably eating about 11:45, 12.
And we don't have any fridge space, so if you bring stuff, if you could bring
your dietary needs. Really
food.
What are your restrictions?
We have to finish before 1. That's it.
Yeah, that's it.
We accept meat and fish. People ask. We generally encourage vegetarianism, but people are free to bring whatever they want and offer. We are mendicants, so we live on whatever we receive gratefully, whatever is offered.
So we usually set up the table, and it's nice. It's a very sweet.
The restriction we have about meat eating that is in our rule is that if we see, hear, or suspect that some animal or fish or bird has been killed, especially to give to the monastery, then we have to refuse it. But if it's just something that people have for themselves that they're sharing, then it's our obligation and our training to accept gratefully. Everything that's given to us. So we aim to be easy to support.
So if you do want to come, would you let me know and give me your write your name down and your phone number? And if for some reason you can't come, that you would call us, because I think we've already got about 20 or 30 people coming, so it would be nice to know. Everybody's welcome.
Cheryl?
Oh, the next session, the Wednesday night class, what are you doing? No, we haven't started.